Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Thursday, February 4th, 2016. Time is 1:35 p.m. Members present are Representative Wilson, Pruitt, Kawasaki, Representative Thompson, myself, Representative Newman, Gaddis, Edgman, and Guttenberg. I do expect the other members shortly. Representative Gaddis has to step out for another meeting later. So at this point, Governor's FY16 supplemental request, as much as we know about it anyhow. With that, I'd like to invite Pat Pitney, Director of Office Management and Budget, Pat, to come forward and present the Governor's supplemental. After hearing about the supplemental, we'll have an overview from the Department of Natural Resources, so that should be a fairly lengthy discussion. So, Pat, why don't you go through your supplemental. Let's go through your presentation, and then we'll come back for questions after the presentation. Welcome, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Pitney. I'm the Director for Office of Management and Budget. I'm going to be working off of two sheets, summary sheet, and the I need glasses detail sheet. Yes, exactly. So this particular supplemental is very tight. I think there's only 33 separate, even less than that, less than 30 transactions. In total, they're the two biggest pieces. One is the firefighter or fire suppression funding at $47.5 million in unrestricted general fund. And then the second other significant piece is the language on the permanent fund dividend from the FY16 supplemental.
Pat, why don't you just go to like number one, two, three, four, and
okay.
That'd be an easier
way. So now we're going to go to the detail sheet, and we'll go down one, two, three, four. So the first item, which is on line two, this is a request of $450,000 for the Division of Finance, and it is for the statewide single audit, and this is a cost. This is a payment to the Legislative Audit Division. This particular cost has been $300,000 for the past 10 years, and this year we have essentially a bill from Legislative Audit for that purpose for $750,000.
Why the increase, Pat?
Excuse me?
Why was the increase?
The increase was not because of additional work. It was because it's in the past, the $300,000 was a kind of a set amount that they collected for this. I think in the tough times where everybody's taking a hit, they are charging now more on an hour basis. And based on the hours, it's $750,000, but it's a very unexpected, more than doubling of the bill from Legislative Audit.
And again, well, I see the members. We'll ask questions after this, but I see some eyebrows coming up here, Pat. So this, I think, goes back to just to clarify why we're spending this money, why these costs are here, is because the legislature passed legislation to go back and do individual audits under different departments, and this is for expertise in those departments to do those audits. Is that what it is? We'll get back.
This is more for the general audit work always done
okay. All
the time. This isn't the HESS, the special HESS audit that had come through. The second item is increased caseload and litigation costs for the Office of Public Advocacy. In the fall, they experienced a significant caseload. Among them is the Fairbanks 4, which took a very high, intense time frame, and Office of Public Advocacy was one of the main players in that transition. So it's an increase of $118,000. The next two are increases for receipt authority for designated general funds. This is the funding that they estimated to be available to be collected for work on behalf of individuals that they don't have receipt authority for. So this is increasing their receipt authority, and if they do work on behalf of individuals that have the ability to pay, part of it is around the how much is in the permanent fund dividend, then they can collect that funding to cover some of the costs of representing individuals. Item 6. This is in the Department of Corrections. And the Department of Corrections has receives money from the federal government for federal prisoners. And this is the amount they feel relative to the current number of prisoners on that are on the federal responsibility that they can collect for the federal related prisoners, which would offset directly the unrestricted general fund costs. The state gets reimbursed for housing federal prisoners. The not line 7 is a technical correction to add the fiscal note for Alaska Safe Children's Act. This was a last-minute fiscal note at the end of last session. Legislative Finance noted it as a missed technical issue, and it's at $10,000. Line 8 is a grant that we were successful in attracting, assuming we have receipt authority, and it's for diesel emission reductions. And this is a grant that will allow certain entities to buy cleaner diesel equipment. There's no match, and there's no ongoing cost to the program. Line number 9 and line number 10 on the next page are formula cost increases for subsidized adoption and foster care. And this is strictly based on the formula associated with the number of kids in subsidized adoption and foster care. So beyond the fire suppression costs that have already been incurred, those two items are the next largest items in the supplemental request. And this is, again, just based on the number of children in both subsidized adoption and foster care. It's covering the formula amount of those costs.
Mr. Chair, are we taking questions at the end, or can we, the end?
So lines 11 through 14 are increases to the juvenile justice facility staffing and cost of health care. And juvenile justice, the Division of Juvenile Justice has had roughly $1 million adjustment every year for the last 7. In fiscal year 17, we've added that adjustment into the FY17 base request. It hasn't always been a supplemental because prior to this year, the Commissioner of Health and Social Services had the ability to move money across appropriations to a certain amount, and this funding was covered mid-year with that ability to shift funding within Health and Social Services. Prior to the Commissioner having that, you will find this $1 million adjustment almost every year in the supplemental. And again, we hope to never come back for that because we put it in our base for 17. Line 15 is our receipt authority to be able to collect for payments made that were over and above claims. So providers, and actually this is school-based claims, where an amount of money was sent to them that was in excess of the amount after looking at the claims. It allows us to get back that overpayment. So we're just getting back the money that was over and above what was required for the claim. And receipt authority. Items 16, 17, and 18 are in the Department of Law. Line 16 is there's a pending tobacco cessation litigation. It's a multi-state arbitration, and we will have attorneys part of that process, and this is using tobacco funds. This request is for tobacco funds to be to help offset the workload associated with that particular case. The next two items have to do with work that the Department of Law does on behalf of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission and the Regulatory Commission, and it's requesting receipt authority payment for the workload associated with the legal work for those two entities based on the receipts of those entities. So Oil and Gas and Oil and Gas Conservation Commission collects fees from the industry to cover all of their costs. This is the law portion of those costs, and same with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. It's fee-driven, and so this is covering the law costs of legal work on behalf of the Regulatory Commission, having those receipts cover that work. The next item 19, is the fire protection activity that was done this summer, major fire in the Wasilla area, other fires. It was a relatively high fire year this year, and this is the $47.5 million are the costs incurred through 16 for fire activity and the declared emergencies for summer and fall 2015 fire season. So this money has already been spent. There's possible, if we have an early fire season this year, we could see additional fire costs for FY16. It's unknown, and partly it is waiting and seeing. Hopefully there's not. But this is for costs already incurred on fires. Line 21, and line 22 are Department of Revenue Treasury divisions. This is for external management fees associated with three fairly large funds. One is the Health Insurance Fund for Long-Term Care Retirement System, the Public School Trust Fund, and the Power Cost Equalization Fund. So this is where we have external management companies managing these as fees incurred to manage those funds. And line 23, line 24, line 25, and line 26 are all Department of Transportation, and these are non-general fund, so designated general fund and other fund requests to accept receipts collected in the various components. So airport leasing in the central region, airport leasing in the northern region, and airport leasing in the South Coast region. So this is funding available, but this is then matching the receipt authority with the available funding and also with measurements and standards. Okay. That brings us down to line 29. And line 29 and line 35 are both for the Alaska Land Mobile Radio System. Line 35 is a reappropriation of roughly $1.3 million. And line 29 is a request for $1 million. This would provide $2.3 million to meet the necessary upgrades of the software and hardware to maintain that system very short term. We anticipate not for fiscal year 17, but for fiscal year 18 and beyond, something in the range of $5 million a year to maintain this system. It is the emergency communication system for the state, Department of Natural Resources, DMVA, and the troopers all use this particular communication system. Line 30 is a request to meet the needs to have the emergency repair of the water lines in the Anvil Correctional Center. Late last spring, they spent $700,000 of deferred maintenance money to patch it. They had to drop the number of prisoners and ration water to keep the facility open. The 1,084 is the amount that would be required to have the long-term fix of that water line. Right now, it's just a temporary fix. Roughly 100 prisoners are in the Anvil Mountain Correctional Center on a daily basis. Line 31 is after the settlement on the Aklutna overpass, there's still a $344,000 need after the insurance settlement to cover that emergency repair on the Aklutna overpass. One-time item associated with the settlement, insurance settlement. Let's see. Okay, now into the language section. So line 35, we talked about that reappropriation for the Alaska Land Mobile Radio. In commerce and the railroad, this essentially it's a reappropriation from the Tanana River Bridge for the railroad, from the Tanana River Bridge project that has been completed, to be a match against Federal Transportation Authority money to finish the positive train control upgrades that are required by federal law. We are able to get a 90-10 match on this funding, reappropriating completed project money of roughly $1.7 million to complete the $17 million positive train control project, and finally, after years, having that off the state books. Line 37 are judgments and settlements through the Department of Law, and there's backup on that if we want to go into it later. And 38, line 37, and line 38. Line 40, the language, so this is two-part. This is, given the Governor's Permanent Fund Protection Act, the permanent fund dividend amount is estimated to be $700 million. And the appropriation in the FY16 bill said for the dates for the appropriation in the FY16 bill had it for dividends paid during fiscal year 16. The fiscal year 16 dividends have already been paid, so that language is technically incorrect. The Permanent Fund Protection Act will have $700 million associated with the dividend checks from the earnings reserve account. And so this was when the administration thought that the $1.4 billion appropriation for dividend checks was, the dates were appropriate or accurate for next fall, we assumed we would use 700 of that $1.4 billion for the checks for the fall of 16. Given that the date was incorrect, in the amendments we'll put $700 million in from the ERA for checks in the fall of 16. So, but Ledge Finance brought to our attention that, in fact, the dates were in error, and since the fall 15 checks or fiscal year 16 checks were already paid, that this was kind of an invalid appropriation. So it's cleanup. There's lapse appropriation language and there's retroactive appropriation language, so it's consistent with language required for the supplemental. And an effective date in the language section. So with that, now I'm ready for questions.
Thank you, Pat. On line, let's go to lines 9 and 10. First off, take it on line with number 10. Why aren't those in the base? Why don't we see those in the base? If you know that they're going to be anticipated to continue to grow, they have been growing, why aren't they included in the base to start with?
Representative Newman, I would say that was my my inexperience in the fiscal 16 year budget, and you will see that there is an increase in the fiscal year 17 budget that more closely matches what we expect to see in foster care, but it is a formula-driven amount based on the number of kids in the system.
On number 9, then, why wasn't that anticipated with the fiscal note on that?
Representative Newman, I don't understand the question.
Well, the Office of Children's Services anticipates a 19% increase in the number of children. Memory serves me right. We put more money in to bring in more children. To add more people in OCS to deal with that, which is probably dealing with the same people that they are. But when we did that appropriation to add those more people in there to cover those costs, why wasn't this part of that?
Representative Newman, I believe that it was associated with the actual case workload of the individuals, and they were given the high case workload. It was to spread the existing workload. I don't think it was anticipated that there was going to be this increase in those that needed service.
We'll work on that one later. I'll talk to you on that one. Representative Garen Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just since we're on item number 9, so this isn't for additional workers. This is to pay the daily base rate that you pay foster families, right? $30 for a kid without special needs up to over $100 to kids with special needs, right?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, this is the per-person costs associated with the individuals receiving the care, the children receiving the care.
The money that goes to the foster families.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And through the chair, just so I understand, because it says special needs, but the bulk of the foster kids who you're paying the daily reimbursement rate, so we went from 2,500 kids to now 2,800 kids, and this is a supplemental to pay for those extra kids in the system, the daily rate. It's not just special needs kids, right? Even though the title says special needs, it's for kids with and without special needs. It's all of them. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, yes, it's all.
Okay.
It's the total cost of the formula program associated with foster care.
And just to be 300% clear, this isn't for any additional staff. This is what we statutorily pay for the daily foster parent reimbursement rate, right?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, yes.
And thank you. And then one other question, Mr. Chair, on the permanent fund.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. At first, I thought I didn't understand something on the permanent fund. So does the supplemental reflect the current formula, which is, unless it's changed by statute, we're going to probably owe something like $1.4 million to pay the permanent fund dividend? Is that correct? Or does yours supplemental anticipate the passage of the governor's change in the dividend?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the supplemental assumes the passage of the proposal of the governor's, the dividend proposal in the governor's plan.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
I guess maybe I've missed it in the past, but I've never seen a budget based upon the contingency that a bill that changes, well, in this case, the dividend formula will pass. It seems like we have a formula on the books right now. The formula on the books right now, estimate, formula on the books right now says what the dividend will be. If the governor's bill passes or a different bill passes, that number would change. But why would you put in the budget a permanent fund amount, dividend amount, for a formula that hasn't been adopted yet?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, this proposal represents the governor's plan. It's the governor's budget. The governor's budget reflects most of the proposals, but the specifics on this particular repeal is the language said this amount was appropriated for fiscal year 16 dividends. Fiscal year 16 dividends have already been paid.
Through the chair, this has nothing to do with the fiscal year 17 dividend. I thought I heard you say that you were changing the amount of the projected appropriation based on the passage of the governor's new dividend plan for FY 17.
So, through the chair, Representative Guerra, that proposal will come in the FY 17 amendments of $700 million.
I guess finally to close.
Final question,
Chair. All right. So this is FY16. The governor's FY17 budget. Does that reflect dividend payments based on the current statute, or dividend payments based upon the passage of the governor's bill?
Through the chair, it'll be, Representative Guerra, it will be the dividend amount as proposed by the governor's bill.
That's the odd thing, Mr. Chair. I just don't think we've ever done that before.
Pat, I was looking through here, and I don't see the $200 million that was vetoed from the oil tax credits in this supplemental. How do we plan to deal with that debt, that $200 million that was vetoed?
So the plan for the oil and gas tax credits is really the oil and gas tax credit reform bill that's put forward by the governor. In that bill and through the Ada Loan Program, it is anticipated that there will be a transition fund set up for the oil and gas tax fund would have the amount that would cover all of the FY16, all of the FY17, and all of the FY18 earned tax credits, assuming that the oil and gas tax credit reform bill passes. The FY17 governor's budget includes $73 million, which is the minimum statutorily required amount for oil and gas tax credits. Assuming the oil and gas tax credit reform, there would be $1 billion for the oil and gas expected to be earned oil and gas tax credits through the current system. We expect that the current system to be close at the end of fiscal year 16, but there's still, because of the tax years, those credits earned through the end of fiscal year 16 will be paid in fiscal year 17 and fiscal year 16, 17, and 18. So there would be $1 billion in that fund to pay for all earned tax credits through June 16. And then there will be $200 million to capitalize an ADA oil and gas infrastructure development loan fund. So
the $200 million you just spoke then is to pay the debt that we incurred when he vetoed the $200 million? You're talking about there's going to be another $1 billion in tax credits due. But is it going to be $1.2 billion then? Because we owe $200 million now.
No. The billion includes the $200 million
it does
in this year.
Yes.
It's $200 this year, $500 or $600 next year, and $300 the next year. Yeah, $200 this year, $500 and $300.
And $200 is the debt from?
Yeah.
Okay. One other one is, thank you. You're back. There's a reappropriation of $1.6 million from the Tanana Valley Bridge project, which I believe is they came in under bid, and that was what was left, to the positive train control. Last year, through legislation, the railroad came to us. They needed $55 million more. We authorized them to bond their own bonds, so there's no state obligation, for $38 million. And they told us at that time, and we told them at that time, that that's it. Don't come back for any more money for positive train control. Yet we're coming back now with $1.6 million towards positive train control. That doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, it supposedly was a done deal. They aren't going to ask. We aren't going to give any. Yet we're coming back now with a supplemental to give them $1.6 million more.
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, or Chair Thompson, it was 38 and 55. The difference between 38 and 55 is 17.
Right.
We have the opportunity to pay for the 55 with 90-10 Federal Transportation Administration match. And so this reappropriation provides the 10% match against that federal transportation, federal funding to complete the $55 million project.
I thought that the federal transportation dollars that we were going to receive in the next 2 years would be used to pay payments against the bond that they were taking out, and that's where they were showing us that there was not going to be any money owed by the state, and that it was going to be not having to come out of their revenue because they could use those federal transportation dollars to make the payments on this big bonded amount. You're trying to change the dials or something here.
Two different sets of federal transportation money. So the payments for the $38 million will come out of their annual amount. Okay. This was an amount in addition that is outside of their normal amount that is on a 90-10 match that would allow the completion of this project.
And these funds you're speaking of then can be used against the positive train control?
Correct.
Thank you.
Do they still need that much bonding authority then?
Yeah, they do.
Through the chair. It was a $55 million completion, and the 38 plus the 17 gets us to that 55.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just starting at the very beginning, the first one, I was just a little bit confused about. So on line two, essentially what you're saying is the legislative department has requested extra money of your Division of Finance for the completion of an audit, and I guess I'm just confused how that could happen.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the payment to legislative audit for this particular item for the last more than at least the last 10 years, we didn't go further back than that, was $300,000. A recent memorandum of agreement asked charge and cost to the administration increase from $300,000 to $450,000. It's kind of a short notice. Given the constraints that all departments are facing, kind of short notice surprise, we will include this in our amendment, assuming that this will be the cost we're charged going forward.
I guess, so you don't feel as if you're being gouged by the legislature?
through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I'm sure if they count the hours on the audit, it's probably consistent with the hours. It's just it was a bill that we were planning to be $300,000. It was now $450,000, or now is $750,000. And in that short time frame, it cannot be accommodated within the budget. I don't think legislative audit is trying to do anything other than cover the costs that they're incurring now that everything is getting tighter.
Thanks. I have two brief ones. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 19, dealing with wildfire protection, it just seems like a pretty large number that we were off. Did we under budget it, or was it a bad year? And I didn't look at the budget. I don't have the budget in front of me to see what it is projected to be next year.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, this tends to be an item that's not budgeted. It's more experience related and has been traditionally a supplemental request. It was a high fire year. If you were going to budget forward, the reality of being right on budgeting forward on a fire year would be pretty difficult, but you could put an amount. I mean, the fortunate thing on the fire appropriation is if it's not used, it rolls into the next year because of the unpredictable nature of it. And actually, I missed one. The very, very bottom. Further down.
Very last
item. Line number 46. It's ratification of last year's fire activity for $48.8 million. So this is the amount that was not budgeted that's part of this bill is being ratified from fiscal year 15. So, and it really, it's been a practice. The practice can change, you know, probably a $40 million placeholder on any given year is not an unreasonable expectation.
Okay, and then just one other brief one.
Jim Kosak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 29, the ALMR, mm-hmm. and I guess line 35, the corresponding reappropriation, that's currently fixed in our budget in DOA, and it's I don't know how many millions per year that we pay the maintenance on it. And I'm wondering, is this just a one-time capital for the? Help me understand why this is capital, one-time capital for equipment. The description is just not broad enough for me to understand.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, this is upgrading the equipment and the towers and fixing the equipment and towers to address the upgrade, the upgrades and the software changes that also exist. It is a statewide system. It's the emergency communication system. This particular thing is a one-time capital request. There is operating funds for LMAR in the Department of Administration's budget because they're the kind of the maintainers and the keepers of the system. The users of the system are DNR, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and I think a lot of community, many, many municipalities also use the system. But this is not the last cost in. This is an expensive system. They have on their, if you look on the backup for this particular item, there's, you know, upwards of $30 million of additional needs for upgrades and radios and so forth. So those will start at roughly $5 or $6 million increments in fiscal year 18. So this is the backbone of our emergency communication system in the state. We are asking for, are there alternatives?
Okay. Yeah, we would have to kind of a little focused shorter. On the budget finance subcommittees will drill down into these in more depth. We have Representative Guttenberg and Wilson Gaddis.
I just had a brief comment.
Representative Gaddis.
I don't think that we ever went over the unallocated cuts that this body made, and it feels like we're already through that, and we're already talking about supplementals. And I think that it just feels a little out of place to talk about supplementals before we talked about what happened to the unallocated cuts to the budget from last year. So just my personal thing.
Mm-hmm. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Line 16, I got two questions. The first one on line 16, the tobacco settlement litigation. The last line in the description of the impacts is that you're studying the requests of the supplemental money coming in. I understand continuing litigation going on. Have we had settlement costs come back already, and where did they go, and when we get additional settlement funds, are they written off back on this, or do they go into the general fund, and where do we see them?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I believe that all settlement costs either go into the general fund or, depending on the type of settlement, go into the constitutional budget reserve. So they do not come, they do not offset first the cost of the litigation. And then they just, whatever settlements come in, they, depending on the type of settlement, either into the general fund or into the CBR.
If I may, Mr. Chair, and do we see them as receipt authority for those funds? Is that how they come in?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, no, because they go straight into the revenue bank. They do not, they have to be separately then it would be an appropriation of general fund before you would use them. So it's not a receipt authority.
I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood the question. When we receive the monies back, when we receive the settlement funds, how are they categorized? Are they, when we see them, do they come into the general fund? Do we see them as listed as the authority to receive those funds back from litigation, or is it just lumped in to the general fund?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I will have to ask somebody with more experience than myself.
Thank you. Another question.
Maybe we can just get a report on that fund, how much it's generated and where the money's going. Is that kind of where you're asking?
Yeah, and how they're accounted for. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So let's do that with the alcohol fund, too, if we can.
Okay. So line 20 and line 21, the investment management, the long-term care, the additional fees for management, it says better than expected performance fees on both 20 and 21. Are the management fees based upon results? Are the results based, are the contracts for managing those funds based upon better than expected returns on the funds, and is the increase in management fees appropriate for what the increase was?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, yes on both accounts. Okay. Yes, they are based on the performance of the fund, and yes, they're reasonable given the performance.
Do you know offhand how much better the performance was?
So through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I would have to get those specifics from the Department of Revenue.
That's it for now, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. So I'm back on line 9, and this isn't, Mr. Chair, about current. This says the Office of Children Services anticipates a 19% increase. That's huge. I mean, we're looking to taking 19% more children into the system than we have now. Am I understanding that correctly, that this is on anticipated numbers growing, not on current foster homes and the formula?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this is based on the number of children that have come in the system this fall. To date, this is what we expect through the end of the fiscal year, is a 19% increase over last year.
Follow-up?
Rep. Wilson.
You know, I sure hope that bothers more people than just me, because I'm telling you right now, when we increased the amount of money we gave them last year, they have taken many more children into the system that I truly believe could be somewhere else. And then on line 10, we're talking about, again, an increase of subsidized adoptions and guardianships. Now, my understanding is this is different from the previous one, because what we heard from OCS the other day is that this is kind of negotiated with the adoption and or guardian parent on how much extra might be needed for the child. So I guess I'm trying to figure out, first of all, again, is this anticipated? They're making the deal. Does that deal have anything to do with the kind of funds that they have in it? Or is it open-ended and we just get the bill at the very end?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this is based on the number of individuals that are in the process, so the number of children in the process and the amount of money associated with each one of those individuals. It is, as there are more identified children in either the foster care system or subsidized adoption, that amount of funding based on the formula amount per goes up.
Follow-up? This isn't a formula program. This particular one on this line is not a formula program. This is the formula programs on the previous line. You're absolutely correct. This is in addition to the formula for guardianship and or adoption that they're giving, you know, based on different kinds of needs. If the child has no special needs, there's nothing that's a zero, you know, on those families there. If they have some kind of, you know, intensive medical needs, then that number changes. So, you know, I guess I'm just trying to figure out maybe if we had numbers to this, because and maybe that's where the problem, Mr. Chair, is. I don't know what 19% increase is, so that would probably help. And then, again, back to when we're talking about number 10, these are contracts that are being negotiated between the potential adoptive and or guardian parent with OCS, and it is not a formula. So I'm just, that's what I'm trying to figure out. Is it just open-ended, or once the money, I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out how these numbers came.
So through the chair, Representative Wilson, we can give you exact numbers, and I'm sure that is a conversation in the subcommittees, but we can also report on the exact numbers and the differences if we go with subsidized adoption and the cost, the lower cost associated with that over the foster care approach.
And one more follow-up.
Rep. Wilson.
So if we're seeing OCS having 19% more into their system, then I'm not seeing the public defender's office in here, because 90% of those in the OCS process have public defenders. Each parent does. I also don't see whether or not we're going to need more guardians ad litem as well. I don't see something in the Attorney General's office, which we heard yesterday, that how much more that these are costing. So if this number is correct, should we not see those numbers pretty much increase based on what we're seeing here, since they're all tied together?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, all offices are receiving pressures as general fund reductions are being made and as service requirements are either staying the same or increasing. The cost pressures are going to hit, and we're doing the very best we can to serve the population.
Mr. Chair, 19%, we must be giving them a lot of money if they can absorb 19% increase in their workload. So, but my point is here, I don't think we have that many children need to be leaving the home that is at 19%. That is really disturbing for me, especially since I have a lot of my constituents into this. When I have seen there are ways that this department, they don't start changing and make it to where there's other options besides taking and breaking up families. This is just the beginning of it, because those families don't get put back together, and then you see it in corrections and you see it everywhere else. That's just awful.
Okay. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess for starters, on line 20, and I understand that you're going to get us some information on that, and not to be flippant, but I'd like to know who those investors are, because my portfolio hasn't gone up, but rather down. But so, I mean, I find that kind of interesting, but when we get the numbers from you, then I think I'd like to drill into that a little bit deeper. But that being said, I want to go to 29, and in regards to Almar, and I think one of the questions that I'm asking is, why were these funds not requested in the budget, and how did they become part of the supplemental at this point?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, they were requested by the Department of Public Safety through the Department of Administration as part of our budget process. The governor, as each of you are scrutinizing every cost, we acknowledge the need of the system and ask them to go back and see what they could find to mitigate that cost for the deferred maintenance, or, you know, the maintenance of the system and the necessary upgrade, just because it's a vendor-based system. They came back with this, the reappropriation, which didn't meet their needs, nor does the roughly $2.3 million meet their needs. It was $5 million request, and we're just saying we're in tough times. Really figure out how you can use this amount of money to the best needs to keep the system going.
And, Mr. Chair, this is in my budget, so, you know, we'll drill down a little deeper in subcommittee. If I might, I have a question in regards to line 31, so in regards to the Eklutna overpass, which I'm very familiar with. Mm-hmm. But I guess my bigger question, so it's hit in 2010, and now it becomes a fiscal year 16 supplemental. So, I mean, we had 6 years that went by, and I guess a couple things. You know, why now versus then? And secondly, was it a private carrier that we couldn't get the differential from, or was it a company that we could have gone through their insurance to get that difference?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, this was after all of the settlements, after you dealt with the company mm-hmm. and what they would insure, and then what the cost was that was left. So this was the reason it took so long is, number one, the work was done, and then the disagreement happened, and then everybody worked through the disagreement, and this was the amount of project funding that was required after all of the settlements. So it just took that long to do the work and settle all of the settlements.
So I get the length, but was it a company? And if so, could we have gone to the company for that difference? I realize that their insurance only paid so much, is what I'm hearing you say, and by the time our insurance, their insurance, whatever, we still have some left over. I mean, basically, they hit the overpass. Did we attempt to try to go to – I mean, are they in business?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, we can get you the exact pieces of that settlement, but this was – it was the closure of the settlement – after all of those pieces were done, but we can get you those kind of details. But this was post all of the agreement with both the company and the insurance company.
Well, and I understand that, and thank you. I'm looking anywhere we can to go to folks that, you know, made the problem and, you know, pay for your damages anywhere the state doesn't have to.
Why didn't they pay for it? I mean, the people who caused damage, that's the final question. Why didn't they pay? Why aren't they paying for this? I understand it was an insurance settlement.
Yeah. So I don't know the specifics of who is involved, but I do know that this was the settlement agreement after all parties were involved and closure, absent going to court.
We can have the subcommittees dig in.
Right. Mr. Chair, I had one more as we went through this. I'll
thanks.
Go on.
And
thanks.
Representative Kawasaki, or I guess it was Representative Wilson, you know, on your record detail sheets, page 8, they had a little bit more on.
There's no numbers, Mr. Chair. I am reading it.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to echo Representative Wilson's concerns on line 9 about the foster care special needs. 19% is a huge increase, and if there's something going on that necessitates that number of increased cases, that's something we need to know about. We'll drill down into. But it also says there's no increase in the governor's amended budget. I guess I don't quite understand the process enough to know why you're coming back for $2.6 million now and that doesn't get built into the base if you assume there is that continuing need.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it's not in the amended budget. It was an increase we put in the fiscal year 17 proposal.
If I could, Mr. Chair, another.
Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Flipping back to lines 24, 25, and 26, indicate about a $700,000 increase in collections on airport leasing. We heard from the Commissioner of Transportation that they have not modified their lease rates, so I'm gratified this increase, but does this mean that there's been some airports where there has been increases in lease rates, or can we attribute this increased collections to just more leasing activity? Is it rates or volume?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it is in the receipt authority, thus the ability to utilize those receipts.
Okay. And is that predicated on an anticipation of more leasing or anticipated higher rates?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this is predicated on what they are collecting in this year based on the rates that they have for fiscal year 16.
So no change in rates? So there must increase.
So through the chair, Representative Sadler, I couldn't guarantee that there wasn't an increase in a rate in one of those airports, but it is not predicated on a wholesale rate increase. This is based on the rates being paid this year and what was anticipated to be collected. And the receipt authority had prior to this was below the amount of revenue collected.
Then I will say on behalf of this.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I will say on behalf of the Transportation Subcommittee, I hope that the next year's FY17 budget would increase the receipt authority on account of increased leasing rates. That's a potential area for harvesting some bucks. Thanks.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some problems with following up on Representative Thompson's comments on the railroad, but I want to correct a couple of things, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Pat. Maybe it was a misspeak, but there was I heard something that troubled me. We did add staff to OCS because they were understaffed last year. That's when we had 2,500 kids in foster care, and now it's 2,800. The number's gone up 1,100 over the last 6 years, from 1,700 something now to over 2,800. It's been a constant progression. OCS has gotten more aggressive about taking kids out of their homes. That's something we could talk to OCS about. But that the number of kids taken out of their homes has been a six-year process. It's not related to the 27 people who were hired last year. Those were staff that were needed. It's not like those staff were hired to take more kids out of their homes. Frankly, the extra staff has now been eaten up by the new 300 extra kids put into the foster care system almost, and that's agonizing to me. But if folks want to talk about why OCS is doing this, I'm open to the discussion too. But there are just more kids in the system now. It's terrible. And then on line 10, the subsidized adoption increase, that's actually in some sense a good thing. This is you're getting kids out of the system. You're getting them into a permanent home. That's what you're supposed to do. And the state, to encourage people to adopt kids out of the foster care system, subsidizes the adoption cost. It's good that they're getting kids out of the system, but we can talk more about that.
You have a question?
On the railroad item, Pat, $1.6 million to the railroad. A few questions. I mean, the railroad gets to run autonomously. My sense is they eat up every single extra penny that comes in there, and then we never see it, and then they come to the legislature for more money. Has anybody in the administration looked inside the railroad to see whether they can cover this cost for the positive train control system?
Through the chair, Representative Gart, yes, and it was a $55 million cost. They were able to bond using their revenue for $38 million of it. We were able to secure a 90% match if we could come up with the 10%, which this reappropriation from a prior project that's complete allows us to get that. So out of a $55 million commitment, they're finding all but 1.6 or 1.7 million of it through the railroad. So we're asking them to fund absolutely as much as possible. It was a big requirement by the federal government for this on a train system that doesn't have that many passengers.
Just one other question on the railroad, Mr. Chair. This is mostly for the subcommittee. Still concerned, but I guess the other question really is if you're looking for extra money for the railroad to pay for the positive train control system, don't we have a project going towards building a longer rail line to Point McKenzie that you can tell me how close we are to completing that, but it seems we're so far away from completing that. Is there not some unspent money in that project that we could use until we have enough money to complete the rail spur, if that's something the legislature decides to do?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's very possible that there's funds there. That project is not complete. We look to funds of a completed project.
That's correct. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to follow up on the railroad as well. So can't we loan the money to them and have them pay it back in receipts like they were going to do on the bonding portion of it?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, that would be a provision that if the legislature chose to go there, work with the railroad and find out if that's possible.
I think maybe a loan's good because I remember Interior Delegation that ate about $80 million of that and had no capital projects. We were kind of hoping that million would come back to us.
I remember. All right, let's wrap this up. Pat, we will get the amendments by day 30, particularly ones that allocate the unallocated reductions.
Chair Newman.
I knew that was coming.
It's a lot of work. A lot of work. We are progressing towards that date.
Yeah, we need them. Thank you. With that, let's take a very, very short brief at ease while we set up for DNR. Well, Finance Committee back to order. Today, again, we have Department of Natural Resources presenting. I see Ed Fogles here. I don't see Mark Myers. I seen him here earlier, but Commissioner cut out on us. So, Deputy Fogles.
Okay.
And then let's get through this, then we'll come back for questions after.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Commissioner Myers had to step out. He will be back momentarily. So I can start off the presentation. This is our budget overview for your committee. And we have a lot of background information in this presentation that I think we can go through fairly quickly because I think most of the members of this committee are fairly familiar with the department, but here is the high-level overall organizational chart of the commissioner and myself and the other deputy, Marty Rutherford, and all the divisions, and the commissioner has just joined us, so I will turn the microphone over to him.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mark Myers, Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and we're going to go through these early slides really fast. We understand we're under a real-time constraint. Next slide, please, then. So if you look at, again, I know folks in the committee are pretty familiar with DNR, very familiar in many cases, but wanted to highlight our missions, and this helps to bucket where our money goes and what we fundamentally do with it. So the first, again, is to look at our overall missions to develop, conserve, and maximize use of Alaska's natural resources consistent with the public interest. You know, when you think about Alaska, it's amazing. We have 160 million acres of total land, submerged land and surface lands, size of the state of California, actually a little bit bigger than the state of California. We have a resource endowment that's world-class. We're in many categories. If we were a nation, we were in the top 10 in terms of our mineral endowment, oil and gas endowment, best in the Arctic, one of the best in the world. As you know, our timber, our agriculture, our lands, our water. We have about 40%, I believe, of the United States' surface water. Minnesota has 10,000 lakes. We have 3 million, put it in perspective. We have 12,000 miles of river. I mean, 12,000 rivers, I'm sorry. So world-class resources all the way around. And, of course, that resource endowment is what empowers our economy. So our first core service is responsible commercial development of use of land and natural resources consistent with the public interest for long-term wealth and employment. Again, that's very specific to the economic development that comes with the lands, whether it be renewable, like tourism, or non-renewable, such as oil and gas and mining. All these, crucially together, form our fundamental economy. And as you know, because development on federal land is so restricted, even though they have more than 200 million acres to our, you know, our 160, most of the development occurs on state lands or on the 44 million acres of native lands. So we are very dependent on those state lands to develop our economy and drive our economy. And much of our economy that's not directly related to our development or resources is dependent on the economic development that's associated with it. So our community development, forestry, while it doesn't bring in a lot of money, it brings in a lot of money to local communities and builds sustainability, same way with agriculture. So when you look at incredible endowment, unlike any other state, we had an external study done and looked at us, and we are unique in the sense of having that level of endowment and that sort of return. We have the highest return on that resource of land than any other state. So that responsible development, people tend to think of DNR in the terms of a historic DNR in Lower 48, which is primarily a regulatory agency. We are primarily a commercial economic development agency when you look at us. So managing those resources, managing the royalty side, and making sure there's, again, availability of capital coming out of that for taxes. So our tax structure is really a derived product off our resource development, off our royalties, if you want to think about it in terms of our economy. So I really wanted to stress that because DNR is very sensitive to the ability for us to do rational, prudent development of our lands. So as we look forward then, the second major mission is to mitigate threats to the public from natural hazards and provide comprehensive fire protection on state and private lands and municipal and through identifying significant geological hazards. So as we go forward then and look at it, that hazards work, we heard about the supplemental budget on fire. Last year was the second largest fire year on history, over 5 million, about 5.1 million acres burned. 2004 was the most with 6.6. Everything indicates fire will increase. And so the cost of fighting fires are huge, a big part, probably our largest chunk of budget. But we have earthquakes, the 7.1 earthquake reminded you in the acreage we have. We do a lot of the work with hazards risk with earthquakes, the landslides in Sitka, another example where we have a lead position, volcanic eruptions, floods, coastal erosion. So we live in a dynamic environment, and the work we do largely through our geological survey to understand and mitigate and warn about those hazards is very crucial piece of our mission in addition to the fundamental mission around firefighting. Provide access to state lands in public use, settlement, and recreation. We sell lands for agricultural uses and for public settlement uses. We also make sure that state land is available, whether it be a small dock permit that you need, whether it's access across lands. Often we know we're having great problems with the federal government. So that piece is significant. And finally, ensure data. We are an agency that uses lots of geological data. We create data. We provide it to people. We provide all sorts of other data that's necessary to manage that land and to work with our other stakeholders for environmental impact studies and our permitting processes. So that, in a nutshell, kind of describes our four core mission areas. You can see on the slide the dollars devoted to each of those and the percentages. By far, our largest amount of funding goes to economic development. Next slide. Land ownership, real quick. I talked about that. The checkerboard nature of that landscape, the pink area or the kind of orangey pink area there, being the state lands, they're also scattered over that vast landscape. So connecting those lands, getting access across federal lands, managing this remote, the remoteness of the land is not cheap. We have to go out to these sites. We have to manage without most of our lands not being associated with a road or airport access. Next, please. Put it last at a scale again. The red dots on this chart show our locations of our offices. You can see the perspective of the scale we're looking at. The scale also reflects on the complexity and the variation in our landscape from arid deserts to temperate rainforest, and the resources based on those are extremely varied. So this is a very complex. It's also the least mapped, the most poorly understood part of the United States, and really one of the least mapped and understood places in the world. We're probably pretty close to the bottom of the ocean in terms of our lack of understanding. So that, again, that data acquisition, understanding, evaluating, and maximizing value requires us to do a fair amount of work in terms of that data acquisition and evaluation. Next slide, please. So our divisions, I'll just race through these. We have 7 major divisions and 3 major offices: Division of Agriculture, Division of Forestry, the Geological Survey, Division of Mining, Land, and Water, which was 3 separate divisions way back and now combined into 1 for efficiency.
Let's take a little bit of time to mention your budget numbers on them.
Okay. Let's go back. So, again, with Division of Agriculture, you can see is about 3.7% of our budget, 39 positions, about $7 million, of which 2.8 is UGF. Division of Forestry, again, our largest budget, and this does not include the supplemental fire budgets that you just saw, but about $24 million of UGF, $43 million in total. 88% of that budget is fire suppression. The rest of it goes to forest management of the state forests and providing timber for forest harvests, timber sales for forest harvests. Division of Geological Surveys, about $8.5 million budget, of which $4.4 million is undesignated general funds. This is probably our most leveraged division with actually respect to outside funding. They are more than 40% dependent on outside funds that they get to do their research. Division of Mining, Land, and Water, the UGF budget of $9.66 million out of $26 million total budget. Again, our largest division with 205 people. Next, please. Division of Oil and Gas, certainly our most lucrative economic division and probably our most technical with the highest level of more expensive, highly skilled geologists, engineers, commercial analysts, et cetera, which is about 11% of almost 12% of our budget, 111 employees, a $9 million UGF, and about $22 million total. Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, which operates the largest park system and acreage in the country, 133 full part-time budgeted positions. It's about 8.6% of our budget and $3.227 million of UGF out of $16.6 million total budget. Parks is one of our, again, our divisions where it's very concentrated on becoming independent of state UGF. You can see a relatively minor percent, a huge, I think, about an 8-to-1 ratio of volunteers to employees, and about 40% now independent of general fund in terms of its ability to raise money on fees for the use of the facilities. So it's a very good news story. We have a legislation before you, which will come before you, a parks bill that allows for merchandising, which we hope to see in this body, and that will allow us again to, we hopefully get up to maybe 50% of our UGF. Next slide, please.
This is it.
That's it, okay. Major offices. We have the old pump office. I guess we don't have a slide for office.
No, I'm sorry.
There we go. Division of Support, thank you, Ed. Division of Support Services, key division. With us, they do far more than administration. They run our recorder's office, a crucial function for the state, which pretty much pays for itself. They also run our IT infrastructure, and they run our HR and other support services. They do much of our contract support, so when we have sales and other contracts, they manage that for us. So out of that, they're about 7% of the budget. And about $13 million total with about $5.6 million UGF. You can see administrative services makes up only about $2.3 million of the UGF. The rest is in IT, and then the recorder's office is pretty much self-funding. And, of course, the other two other elements is the Office of the Commissioner, a relatively small part of our budget, and then a relatively large part of our budget that's additive and new is the North Slope gas commercialization, new in the last several years. That is pretty much self-contained. They do receive support, direct support from other divisions, like particularly Division Oil and Gas, for working on the gas line. But they have 21 budgeted positions. Of those, five are filled with state employees, several are unfilled, and the remainder are filled with contractors. And these are, so let's keep going then. OPUMP is, again, our Office of Project Management and Permitting. You know, there's been a very strong desire of this body as well as within the department and in the administration to accelerate permitting, make it easier, make it more coordinated, not compromise it, but make it more efficient. The faster we commit projects, the, of course, the better we have for economic development. The better and stronger the process, the less public concern there is on the project and the less litigation. So in order to do that in a coordinated fashion, we have the Office of Project Management and Permitting. Its total budget there is about $7.7 million, but you see its UGF is less than $1 million, and that much of it is funded, about $5.6 million funded from project applicants. So they permit large projects in a very coordinated fashion. They work with the federal agencies and the other state agencies to provide that coordination. Mental Health Trust Land Office is really a pass-through office. They report to the Mental Health Board. Their function within DNR is to manage the mental health lands to return the value for mental health programs. Performance measures, just real quickly, this is the mining land and water permit backlog. You provided significant funding in 12 and 13. Moving forward, you can see the success on getting the background to about 1,000 from a peak of 2,600 permits. And this year, 2015, 93% of the permits applied for were granted within the year. So huge improvements. This goes along in parallel with the Unified Permitting Program, the desire to create a single application structure for permitting and processing of permits. Next, please. We just threw another permitting one in here. The OPUMP coordinated projects. You can see that, again, this is user not required, but user-desired and user-funded structure. But you can see the amount of projects in the last 3 years keeps growing. And mainly, in this case, oil and gas projects in the orange have grown significantly. But large mining projects and large renewable energy projects and transportation projects like to use this service. Again, largely self-funding. The UGF in this goes for helping us evaluate often the changes in federal permitting processes, using that as a vehicle to make state comments back to say, where we think new federal standards are problematic, and provide that information both to the commissioners and the governor's office, and then that goes back in as a coordinating body for the state comments to go back in. We recently we've used them for things very, very recently in terms of the Obama administration's recommended or structural changes to permitting, whether it be in mining, oil and gas, whether it be in general land use management. Next, please. So I want to look really quickly at 15-16 budget. Mr. Chair, I'll go through this very quickly, if you'd like. Okay. So the story in 16 was the UGF in DNR was reduced by $7.6 million, about 10%, and 76 positions. And we have a handout, I believe the committee has, that lists all those positions. It lists the status of the people that were actually in those positions or not, whether they retired, whether they were terminated, or whether they moved to other jobs in the organization. And we also have them by job class, and so professional versus clerical versus technical. And maybe we take a second here. I know there's been a lot of questions on are these positions real, are they not? You know, is it fat? Is it you know, real bodies? So I'd like our admin service support director to discuss these positions a little bit, if we got a minute.
And thanks, Commissioner, for bringing that to the committee, because there's been a lot of questions, so thanks for being proactive on that one.
And thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the record, Fabian Peter Contest, Director of Support Services Division for the Department of Natural Resources. We had an addendum that we put in your packet. It covers the 16 and 17 position deletions. It's a two-page addendum, and if you just focus on the very top line for 2016, we removed 76 positions. One position was transferred to DOT, so it's really a net of 75. 41 were vacant, 34 filled. We laid off 22 people. 9 retired. They were laid off, but they were able and they chose to retire. And then 3 took lateral transfers. We also removed all the funding for those positions. So $4.4 million was removed for the positions. So those positions are gone. The people are laid off, and we can't fill them again. For 17, we currently have 12 positions slated for deletion. At this moment, two are filled. The details, you can see, I think the key point on the types of positions we laid off were that approximately 34% of those are professional level. They are experts. They are highly educated, specialized, difficult to replace those kinds of folks. And then you can see the percentages, 39% technical level and 26% entry level. And you can look at the location, and you can also look by division if you'd like. And the details of every single position and the types are on the back of that sheet.
Thank you. Good job.
So maybe we'll take a few minutes just to highlight division by division. The overall philosophy in managing the cuts was not to eliminate major programs. When we really looked at the major programs, it would come down to forced ag, and that would have really nasty effects on communities, or eliminating agriculture pretty much in whole. And we didn't want to do that. There are also parts of agriculture that directly relate to other parts, invasive species, for example, invasive plants program for the state. Key issue is within ag, and the inspections for agricultural timber export are within ag. So when we looked at these things, all these divisions cross-fertilize, and there's codependencies, and we wanted to make sure we didn't damage other programs by doing it. So in a nutshell, we decreased certain capacities and programs, knowing it was going to hurt, but we tried not to break things. We went down to the director level and really worked the issues systematically, again, to try to manage the cuts the best we could. But the cuts are real, and they have had some programmatic effects. So we wanted to just give you a real quick idea. And this was in 16, four positions and two scientists out of the State Geological Survey. We also eliminated the airborne geophysical surveys, so we collected no new airborne geophysical data paid for by the state. There was a little bit of LIDAR from DOT and other places we did help process, but fundamentally we stopped collecting the airborne geophysics for understanding our mineral attribution. With that, again, we also cut two scientists that were looking at coal and geothermal energy resources. In the Division of Oil and Gas, nine positions by restructuring work processes. We hit some of our analytical capacity, which makes me uncomfortable, but it's where we are. In terms of understanding the royalty negotiations, the royalty reopeners in terms of leaving it in value, it's very important to understand the market in the West Coast, understand tanker costs, transportation costs, because you can go through reopeners with the companies. Those reopeners have brought up millions of dollars. So we kept the commercial stack as intact as we could, and we actually were able. But we had used a lot of that commercial capacity on the gas line, but not funded by the gas line. So in the gas line supplemental, you did give us money to put two commercial positions back in.
Commissioner, yeah. I think we pretty much read through this, and if we've okay. got questions, we can come back. So if we can get to the governor's highlights and budget highlights.
So if you look at the, the employees through into the 17, as Fabian had said, the additional cuts in the 17 take us down to about 9% change from 2016 in terms of net employees. Also, we went back to show you historically year by year, DNR really didn't grow, is the story, much over that time frame. And you look at the permanent full-time employees in DNR, we were at peak in 2007 and have gone down since. In order to make workload adjustments, we've hired many more temporary part-time and non-permanent positions. So DNR was already managing effectively to workload before by not filling full-time in positions. But now we've cut down significantly below that, so we're 70 positions less than 2007, about 9% in full-time, and our total employees are down about 100, to give you an example. So when people talk about this increase in state employees, certainly in state budgets, it certainly occurred, but it did not occur here in our personnel or in our budget, as we'll show next. Ivan, I'll turn to you again to go ahead and discuss the budget, because I want to make sure you're understanding apples-to-apples comparison in terms of the metrics being used from year to year.
For the record, Fabian Peter Contest, Director of Support Services. Slide 19 is a highly detailed slide that shows how the budget scenarios are developed between 16 Management Plan and 17 Governor. Rather than go through this in detail and really see your eyes glaze over, the next page, page 20, might be a better way of looking at it. We are looking at a comparison between 15 management plan and 17 governors, so we have kind of a picture of where we got from, where we started from, and where we arrived. The bottom line, and I'll start with the bottom line, is the comparisons at the very bottom in blue. Our 16 management plan to 17 governor shows a 43% increase in unrestricted general fund, and you can imagine that's AKLNG, and also a 14% overall increase and an increase in personal in people of 1.3. The next comparison is the 16 management plan to 17 governor, and if you remove AKLNG calculation, we're down 7.5% in UGF and 2% overall. And then again, if you look at the last 2 years of cuts, where we really started reducing state government, between 15 and 17, we're down 16.5% and 8% in personnel. We will talk in the next couple slides of the specifics of the ins and outs. Mostly the outs were the one-time items that come out for adjusted base. We're talking about things like the seed potato program, Mount McKinley meat and sausage, the unallocated reduction, and that's how we get to adjusted base. Then the governor's increments and decrements, and that arrives us to the 17 governor's budget. And then to really, you probably want to hear a little bit more about what the details are on page 21, and we'll talk through these.
So, again, trying to not eliminate any of these really significant major programs, we looked again at where we could try to cut some corners on processes. So the best interest finding, lease sale preparation, publication records for oil and gas communications, two positions cut. It doesn't mean we won't do best interest findings. It's just that there won't be as thorough. There's some risk with this approach, but again, it's that or canceling lease sales. You choose not to cancel the lease sale. Or end the exploration licensing program, we looked at that. Terminating significant programs, and again, we really struggled to try not to do that at this time. Geological surveys, reduced production and content of the mineral report, annual mineral report, still going to produce the report, it's going to have less substance to it. We're not going to trade shows anymore. We get a lot of interest in mining companies and oil and gas companies by going to trade shows and presenting technical presentations, providing information. We simply can't afford to do that now. So we're not going to do that. Interesting enough, we have 16 new independent companies in Alaska from 2013 forward in the oil and gas arena. Some of that is attributable to our ability to show them the technical data in these trade shows when they come down, like NAEP and APG, these huge conventions where the companies are looking at prospects. I'll turn to Ed to talk about the rest of the divisions.
For the record, Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner of the Department. For the mining, land, and water, the governor's budget proposes to reduce our stewardship budget by $363,000. This would reduce our ability to send people out in the field and monitor activities that we've permitted, not eliminate that, but just reduce that. It would also reduce our ability to maintain high-use sites such as the Knik Public Use Area and the Kusilov River. We may not be able to pump out the sanitary facilities quite as often. For the Division of Forestry, we're going to propose to reduce our annual road maintenance in some of our state forests, maybe rather than grading roads once a year, maybe every other year. We're going to cut a long-term non-perm admin position. The governor's budget proposes to eliminate the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas, which would eliminate two positions. Parks Management and Access, we're going to reduce the funding and we'll move a position into the Boating Safety Program, which is federally funded, but that will reduce our ability to issue permits on state park land. We have some part-time administrative position for the Kodiak State Park System that will be eliminated. And then with the Division of Agriculture, we're going to do some light cuts there, reduce our seasonal mechanics capacity. We would reduce slightly our Alaska Grown marketing and some of our farm site inspections and assistance for a total of $87,800.
Again, Fabian Peter Contess. For the Support Services Division, we're deleting a position in the Accounts Maintenance Unit that deals with audits of land sale contracts. That may slow the issue of patents to purchases of, purchases, purchasing entities were buying our land, and also defaulted contracts where we are trying to get the land back and resold back on the market. These are for individual land purchasers. And agency-wide, we're working with the Department of Administration on chargeback. Chargeback we pay for IT and human resources to see if we can find efficiencies on both sides, and also in facilities costs. We're part of the statewide efforts on cross-departmental efficiencies for leases, trying to see if we can find a better way of managing our facilities so that we're not duplicating efforts across agencies. And we're part of a pilot program that's doing that along with other cross-departmental efficiencies. Also agency-wide, I'd like to point out something that's not on the slide, that we started in 16 to meet the unallocated reduction, which was 5-day mandatory furloughs for about 60 senior DNR staff. And that will continue into 17 mandatory 5-day furloughs.
Mm-hmm. And those are on the exempt employees that we can do that. We can't do the same with the union employees, although I think that's being discussed. I want to highlight again the unallocated one-time salary increases. I think there are some expectation we can do this through administrative staff and staff efficiencies. I see no way to practically do that. So our proposal here is to allow us to shift from undesignated to designated general funds. We have more than $20 million of extra generated revenue from designated funds for things like gravel sales that go directly in the general fund. To keep some of these programs to sustain them, we would like to get more authority to use designated general funds. If we can't, when we look at it, this is sort of the bridge too far. This will lead to us shutting down a major program. We haven't gone through the full analysis, but what I'm looking at is a significant reduction in the Division of Agriculture as the most likely, the least harmful of all the cuts, which is harmful. But I just wanted to be frank with you. I can't find it, I don't think, in administrative efficiencies, given what we've already done administratively.
Fund source.
Go ahead, yeah. So this fund source switch, again, that is in this existing budget where we're taking $2 million of UGF into designated general fund. Again, we have the capacity to do a significant amount more of that. We're comfortable on a year-to-year basis. And then looking at it in terms of from a one-time budget item, I believe those were discussed already, Fabian.
No, Ed was going to talk about that.
Okay, Ed, do you want to go?
Sure. I'll do that. And Ed Vogels, Deputy Commissioner. In last year's budget, there were two items that were transferred over to one-time item status. That's the sea potato program and Mount McKinley Meat and Sausage Plant. The governor's budget proposes to reinstate these into our base. The first item, the seed potato program, we feel very strongly that that really should be put in our base, and that's a very critical function of the Division of Agriculture. It is absolutely critical for our agricultural potato industry to start off with clean, virus-free Generation Zero seed. If that ability is not there and that's not provided, then seed will come in from outside and you'll introduce viruses, and the purity of our potato table stock will be hurt. So this is actually very critical for a potato growers industry. The Mount McKinley Meat and Sausage Plant, I think we all agree that we are looking for a different business model for this facility. And last year, by putting this into a one-time item status, I think it did a lot of good in that it forced the conversation amongst the industry that that something different has to happen with this plant. And we are still looking for ways. The industry is very, very active right now in talking about figuring out a way to privatize this facility. Again, to be honest, it's been tried before and it hasn't been successful, but there's a lot of interest in this topic right now. We're also pursuing some other avenues, but we feel that we haven't achieved that yet, so we need a little more time. I do want to point out that a couple of very important points about this plant. It is critical for the South Central's meat industry. Without this plant, the South Central meat industry will be severely damaged. So our plan has to involve some kind of transition. so that this plant can keep operating while we come up with a new solution. If we build a new one somewhere else, we have to have that transition. I also want to point out that this plant right now, that two-some million dollars that it takes to operate this, does not come out of general fund. It comes out of the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund. And even though it does lose $155,000 a year about on average, that money is just a draw on the fund, and the fund is maintaining level and continuing to provide all the loans that the agricultural industry needs. So, in effect, the farmers that have taken out loans, their interest is, in effect, subsidizing this loss. So it's a steady state right now, but I think we all agree that something different needs to happen, and we're working really hard to make that happen.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could talk a little bit about the North Slope gas commercialization, you can see it's a very large part now of our UGF budget. That budget was predicated on, you know, the buyout of TransCanada, the commercial negotiation point that we're at this point. And about half of that money, again, is really money for the division. About $18 million is for Department of Law. Department of Law is not only providing us legal advice, but through contracts with several world-class firms, our two lead commercial negotiators for the project, and they are very good, and I'm very delighted they're there. We're seeing, again, I think, the best negotiating team the state's ever had in my over decade of experience with the gas lines. In addition, there's a significant amount of money in there for marketing. I know we talked about in the special session how expensive marketing is. So that dollar amount for marketing presumed a marketing structure that was fairly complex. We're negotiating commercial structure of marketing with the producers. There are structures that are relatively simple in terms – there's no simple thing in gas marketing and international LNG, but much simpler and much more reliant on the project working together in marketing as a whole. Obviously, that's the state's preferred position. We don't want to be in the equity market all by ourselves competing with our partners in the project. You can see the misalignment that could occur. So we're working on
– We're going to get a lot further into depth in the North Slope commercialization when we get into that issue. Maybe we'll have some questions at the end of your presentation
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to highlight we are looking at ways to cut this budget down, but it's dependent on the marketing structure we end up with, and that's being negotiated as we speak. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, if you look at the breakdown of our budget, again, this graph's really illustrative of where our money goes. You can see fire suppression on the left of this chart. Is the big gorilla. The North Slope gas commercialization is actually the second biggest, following by mining, land, and water, and then we get into oil and gas, and then much smaller portions for the other divisions. So this is a really good look that fire and gas lines sort of dominated us recently as an organization. Again, where we look at the breakdown of our total fund sources, unrestricted general fund in general funds those things that generate the state revenue. Because, again, you can't find matching or grant money for oil and gas lease sale. No one would fund that, whereas they will fund certain scientific work, other components. So the bottom line is that the unrestricted general fund is a very significant component of the dollars that come back to the state. So if you look at it from a ratio, if you looked at all of DNR's expenditures and just looked at DNR specifically generated revenue, it's about $17 for every dollar of total state money going in that pie comes back in terms of general or permanent fund revenue. If you look at it with the derivative taxes coming in as well, it's $39 for every dollar. And that equals about $7.7 million for every DNR employee coming back to the state. So, again, because of our endowment, because of the commercial nature of DNR, these are great investments. These rate of returns are unheard of in any other state. But again, it's really dependent on that general fund piece of that. And we do think, again, a better model is to put more designated general fund in, the money we're bringing in, to be able to sustain these services that are generating these sorts of huge rates of return. Where does DNR sit with respect to other agencies? You can see we're about 1.7% of the budget. So, and that's true with the other resource agencies. And this committee knows by heart these numbers that the service part of government and the formula-driven programs drive the budget. The resource agencies together are a really small part of the budget. And DNR, about 1.7, is one of the smaller parts of your overall budget. Yet that's where the revenue is generated. We've talked a little bit about more. I talked a little bit. I won't dwell on this, but as we move forward, certainly, given the volatility of commodity prices, royalty is more stable as a revenue source than taxes, particularly in our net profit share system. So if you look at this, the royalty is increasingly a higher percentage of our internally generated revenue, and it is, in fact, volatile to commodity prices, but less so. So, and then again, if you look at this, the generation over time, about $2.5 billion over a decade annually comes back in from DNR. This is just to show, again, to highlight that the blue is the taxes in the system and the red is royalties. You see $1 billion there at the bottom. We've seen a significant decline in royalty revenue, but not nearly as volatile as a net profit or tax system. So as you think of your portfolio of income sources, think of royalties under the current system as one of your most stable sources of new revenue. It's also the corpus of the permanent fund, again, under the current system.
Did you want to go through the ledge finance, look back? Is there any detailed information here that you need to add?
Yes, please. Fabian Peter Contest for the record. Just a couple points on these. We have eight graphs. We've split them out with AKLNG, with AKLNG and without. We're starting out with out AKLNG. And just a point on this graph on page 29, we're about 2% of the state's budget. This is general fund and designated and unrestricted general fund. But if you look at our budgets, just the UGF budget over the same period of time, and you calculate the rate of inflation, we're about $8.3 million below the rate of inflation. On page 30, again, without AKLNG, we're still down 98 positions since – actually, 98 positions since 2015. And 64 fewer than 2007. On page 31 – excuse me. Just want to show a couple little bumps. The permitting increased in 2012 and 2013 when we received appropriations from the legislature to reduce permitting, and that was quite effective, as you saw from our performance graph. Otherwise, we have stayed, if you look at UGF only, between 2007 and 2017, we're at $65 million now. We were at $65.9 million of UGF in 2007. So we are flat in UGF. It does not show on this graph, but that's the data. And then the other thing I'd like to point out, and just to hit on page 33, next one, Ed. This is actually general fund with AKLNG. You can see the FY15 management plan where there's a little bump. That's where we first put AKLNG in the budget with unrestricted general fund. In 16, the fund source was changed to in-state pipeline fund. That's an other category, and so you can see the drop on the blue line, and then back up in FY17 governor for the $35.7 million in UGF. So that's where the fund source – you'll see the fund source changes reflected in that blue line. And those are the major points that I just wanted to make with the ledge finance graphs. Thanks.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Ed Fogel. Before we close, I want to make one comment. Some of the direction we've gotten from the legislature, we are still going through the department, our regulations and statutes, and the way we do business to try and figure out ways that we can work smarter, eliminate unnecessary regulations or statutes. That's an ongoing process that I think we've tried real hard over the last several years to work on that, and we're really continuing on with that. We've had one piece of legislation in years past that really fixed a lot of issues with DNR statutes. There are a couple of others. I know that Representative Munoz has introduced a bill to streamline our land exchange process, which is very important to us and will save us a lot of work. We're looking at our mining process for all the way from claims to placer permitting to figure out a way to streamline that. We're looking at better and smarter ways to do our timber sales. because we don't have as many people to do that anymore. So we're looking at other items, such as we're required to regulate low-hazard dams right now. We're questioning whether we even need to do those. We may be able to just reduce our regulatory burden there. And we also are looking at regulations that make us regulate water redirection around construction sites is an example that takes a phenomenal amount of our staff time that we're evaluating whether we can fix those. And then more general permits for things such as docks, wharfs, erosion control structures. So ongoing process to make us work smarter, given that we have fewer resources.
Mr. Chair, if I could just end on a good news story, really short. Earlier this week, I signed, and now on our website is a preliminary best interest finding on a royalty oil sale to Tesoro. It's a case where, as North Slope oil production has declined, available oil for in-state refining has decreased because the large companies have excess tanker capacity and they have commitments to lower 48, particularly California, to supply the California refineries. So in that, our local refineries have been crunched. And so in the process then, we have taken our royalty oil in kind rather than leaving it in value. We just finished negotiation with Tesoro for a contract. And if you figure the contract at a reasonable level, it will provide about $14 million more than we've gotten leaving it in value and shipping over to California. It prevents the refinery from having to import more oil as they were doing from the Bakken in North Dakota. Alaskan jobs are created. Alaskans get to use Alaskan oil in their cars. And we get about $1.95 a barrel more than leaving it with the producers. A tough commercially negotiated deal. That deal is a preliminary best interest finding. It will go to the royalty board, and it will come to you for approval this session. That's an example of how we are working at DNR to use your resources, use the public resources as a multiplier, not just the dollars to the general permanent fund, but actually to create jobs and actually to get more value so you can create a win-win situation. It's not the only royalty oil contract that we are working on. So I expect by the end of the year or so, it's likely we'll have 95% of our oil being sold to in-state refineries in kind. So just those are the kinds of things you need skilled commercial teams to work on, but you can really use our in-state resources as a multiplier, and that's really our goal with DNR with all our resources, provide maximum value internally for Alaskans, at the same time providing the revenue flowing back to the Treasury. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just for the members, Mr. Fogles and Commissioner Myers and myself have had quite a few long discussions on regulations and reviewing regulations within DNR. We're trying to want to focus on DNR as a model project in reducing those regulations as an entity. They've shown they bring the money in by selling Alaska's resources. But yet we continue to have a tremendous amount of regulations out there that put burdens on industry that are just duplicative paperwork. Basically, in a lot of this. So I've asked them to bring us regulations that they need to be able to still protect their mission statement, but let's start considering getting rid of the rest of them and making sure that we continue to make Alaska a good open place to work while still protecting our resources. And so we've called on DNR to do that initially with us. All agencies are working on it. I expect this group to come back shortly with some solid recommendations. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know you guys are going to be in front of the subcommittee. We'll talk a little bit more about this, but this is one time you're going to be in front of the full committee. And the biggest thing that's out there in terms of actual additional UGF is in your budget, and that's the North Slope commercialization. So if it's okay, we're going to talk about that just real briefly. First and foremost, you mentioned the $18 million that's going to go to the Department of Law, and then you also mentioned the marketing. How much of the rest will be the marketing?
Representative Pruitt, for the chair, I don't have those numbers there. It's a significant portion of it. For the FY year, it presumed, again, going to a FEED decision in January. Right now, we are in the process of hiring a temporary six-month world-class expert, six-month contract, to build the structure. And again, we've been delaying that a little bit because the goal is to understand the commercial arrangement we have with the producers that affects the structure that we have. But in one structure, it will be a very much smaller, the structure we prefer, it's a very much smaller organization. So right now, if we can pull the number out of there, it's a significant portion of the ask. Again, that was the kinds of salaries. These guys, you know, approach $1 million or so, particularly more than that sometimes with bonuses. We went out to the market. We talked to you in the special session about the extreme cost of that. So we have not pulled the pin on hiring the person, but as we move forward, we're going to need to have that person, the actual marketer, not just the expert, to help us build the structure in place when we go into feed, because at that point you are actually negotiating your contracts in that feed structure. So when you get to the FID decision, you have your contracts in place. All parties will be doing that. So to get to the, do we have the
I'm
breakdown?
I'm not sure I have it right now.
I'm sorry, Prude. I don't want to throw a number out there. It's
no,
just
that's
important, but
and
it
and
is
I,
expensive.
I appreciate that. Well, can I, if it's okay, can I continue?
Go ahead, Representative Prude.
So the, you know, there was the option to do the joint venture marketing. And this is obvious, this is not joint venture marketing. Have we determined, so essentially have we determined that we are not going to be party to the joint venture marketing, basically saying Exxon, go out there, sell the gas, we'll be a part, we will be a part of it, instead we are creating our own team. Is this the decision that, that has been made and there's not really another option. We don't have the opportunity to have another say into whether or not that's the appropriate policy decision if this money is appropriated.
Representative Pruitt, to the chair, I have to be careful because of the confidentiality.
Okay.
But let me express it in a way. I would do handsprings if we had a four-party joint venture market. I'm really excited about the potential for that. So the state's position has been we see it as a solution in upstream alignment and gas supply. It would help with the gas balancing agreement. We think it would help align cargoes in the downstream expansion, all these things it would help with. We think it's a fundamental alignment piece, but not all our partners agree with that. So the active negotiations are occurring, and there's no resolution yet. So I can't, you know, so we're in the middle of this commercial, and I can't discuss the specifics, but I can tell you, if, you know, DNR commissioner could make the strongest recommendation possible, it would be for joint venture four-party joint venture marketing. And we have made that point clear in DNR's position going forward. But I can't tell you because the negotiations are far from complete, whether we can get there or not. So if we can't, then the other alternatives are individual joint venture marketing with all the producers, which means you have to duplicate staff, right? Now I've got a joint venture with BP, one with Conoco, and one with Exxon. So all of a sudden, my staff size, I have to have a marketer in each one of those organizations. And then I have to have a lead in any case. And then I have to be able to, we have to demonstrate a surety of supply. So I need a few upstream people that can work with the customers to say the supply is here or not here. And so that structure, again, is much larger. That is, second is the structure we designed the budget around. It's still joint venture. Not to say we may not reach alignment with the parties for joint venture. We may end up in a situation where we're equity marketing portion of our gas, in which case I need a whole equity marketing structure. So we were hoping to use
Eastern.
Yeah,
we're staying up at a little higher level right now. Representative Pruitt, I have asked Representative Pruitt to look at this request and look at it in a way of you're looking at commercialization, I think royalty in kind type of structures under this, and law. So I have asked Representative Pruitt, who oversees this budget, to look at that. And to look at when, where, and how those appropriations are let out if we're going to be doing further EK LNG work.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And I think, Mr. Chair, I think you just showed the complexity of this particular piece, which leads me into one other kind of lane of thinking. Is the governor going to call us back to a special session?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I believe he wants to. He wants to have the contracts negotiated. You're familiar with the letter he sent. His expectations are to try to get there. But being pragmatic, I think you've also heard from the during the briefings from the project, including the state components of the project, AGC and Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, that the negotiations aren't there yet. And that they're tough and they're moving, but they're moving fairly slowly. So I can't tell you, I don't know. It's a stay tuned kind of thing. The goal is to have it. If we don't have it, then we'll have to see what the alternatives look like. I think all parties of the project are looking at what those alternatives might look like. You know, and so it's too early to say, but at the current pace, I think it's challenged. And I think you heard that from all the parties. Just being straightforward. Could I make one other suggestion on the marketing piece?
Actually, we have two more questions in just about 2 more minutes.
And if I can just finish in the line of thinking. Thank you, Mr. So will we talk about finances? If we're called back, will there be a financial conversation at that time frame? And what I'm getting at is right now you've just highlighted something that's incredibly complex, and this is the only time you're going to be in front of this committee, and we're going to make a determination on whether we go forward with that. You'll be in front of the subcommittee, and I'm not – but the point is this – it's should we spend more time digging into this as a legislature as a whole? If that's the case, if we're going to be back in a special session, would it be an appropriate thing to wait on this particular funding until we can focus on it along with the rest of the project in the potential focused special session that might come after this?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, great question. The budget has other things other than the marketing piece in there. So the commercial, the money to law for those key negotiators to me is critical because that negotiation will continue. And if we know we have a dead stop at the beginning of the next fiscal year, we may not be able to retain them. And then we might have a break in continuity if we don't in the special session in adequate time by July 1 being able to fund it. So, and there may not be a special session. The other thing I would recommend on some of these complex questions, you've hired very good consultants. I know you renewed the contract with Analytica. We'd be happy to work with Analytica and work through the issues, and they can give you their expert judgment on what we're asking for, whether it's rational, whether it's appropriate in scope, et cetera. An independent check is something we don't object to, and we'll be very open with them.
Thank you. Well, thank you. We just wanted to make sure that you knew and the committee knew Representative Pruitt's looking at this so that we can have further discussions. We have Representative Guttenberg, Kawasaki, and so you can ask them quickly because we got
thank you, Mr. Chair.
1 minute.
A quick observation, and I want to the hardest part about commercialization is that we are public, that so much of what we do is public. That holds us up. But when we leave here, people in this room are going to go out to dinner afterwards, and there's going to be maybe some fish or something on the table that's Alaskan. We're killing our ag industry in this state. I'm almost a farmer. I probably won't get – I know I won't get there. But there are significant things and rules being broken by the private sector and agriculture in this state, from Tim Myers in Bethel to Steve Waterman, Masterman in the interior. People are producing fruit trees. I marketed – well, I produced 10 pounds of apples for my first crop this year. But we are destroying this state's agricultural opportunities. We're not enhancing it. We're not supporting it. We're moving backwards. You know, and I love all the other oil and gas stuff, but we all have to eat. We're getting rid of the farm-to-school program, which was going to be one of the bases of local farmers being able to have produce, and we're getting rid of that. And I just see, I don't know where we're going in this state, where everybody talks about food security, but we're going backwards. Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a technical thing on page 19. This really jumps out. So there seems to be a $1.3 million cut in your UGF from FY16 to FY17. But the big reductions in other, you're going down 20% from $49 million to $40 million. And then the DGF, there's a $2 million decrease. Can you just give us a quick overview why those cuts are so large, the other and then the DGF, and what the DGF is that's being cut?
For the record, Fabian Peter Contest, Director of Support Services. Representative Guerra, through the chair, if you look at page 20, that would probably help us describe where we're getting. The $2 million fund source switch, which is in the FY 2017 governor budget decrements, this is where we reduced $2 million in UGF and increased $2 million in our designated program receipts, our receipts in mining, land, and water, which comes in from material sales, leases, and so forth. That's one of the increases and the decreases. Is that what you were pointing at?
Through the chair, from FY16 to FY17, the cuts to other and DGF outpace the cuts to UGF by a significant amount, especially the other category. I'm just trying to figure out what money is not coming in for in the other category and in DGF. It's usually the UGF that ends up being the biggest cut.
The other, Representative Guerra, through the chair, the other category is the reversal of the AKLNG one-time item of $8.9 million. That's where legislative finance takes the one-time items out, and then you'll see it in the governor's request as a UGF increase in FY17. It was other in the in-state pipeline fund in FY15.
Thanks.
Thank you. If you get Brinkham crossed any further analysis on that, let us know. Representative Thompson, tomorrow's schedule.
Thank you. House Finance Committee will next meeting will be tomorrow, Friday, the 5th of February at 1:30 p.m. here in this room, and at that meeting we'll continue with budget overviews, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, followed by the Department of Administration, and bills previously heard.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And before we gavel out today, we would like to recognize a milestone birthday by one of the committee secretaries, Jody McDonald. Jody turns 50 today. We do have some donuts and some snacks and some coffee for people after the meeting. Want to visit with Jody? Thank you, and thank you for today.